It's my honor this morning to introduce our chapel speaker, Dr. Matthew LaGrange. He's hiding in the back somewhere. There he is. Dr. LaGrange came to DCC in 2009. He was very young. He was a child prodigy. Over the past few years has built what I think is a really unique and excellent program in psychology and counseling here. Y'all don't know it, but the program that we have in counseling psychology here is really special and really unique and different from the programs around us, and he's coming to share with us now.
Well, good morning. It is still morning, right? That was not my fault. I come in like a hurricane, so... how many of you have I had in class? Okay, a good number of you. A number of you have had in multiple classes, and it's been my honor to do that. For those of you who don't really know me, my name is Matthew LaGrange, and I'm making history. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Today, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell just a bit of my story, because my story, I used to think, didn't really have any value for anybody. I used to think that what could possibly be of use to anybody from what's happened in my life and what I've come to learn in my however many years I've been alive. I was 12 years old in 1979. Yeah, so I was a child prodigy if I was here at that point. If you do the math and you do it well, you'll put me somewhere in the later 40s. I've learned that I have stories. I have stories that have value, that have meaning in the lives of people. I also have learned that you have stories. And some of you are sitting there going, you don't know my story, and you wouldn't find it all that interesting. And what I would tell you is that God finds it very interesting. God wants to use your story in some pretty amazing ways. But it's important for you to understand what that story is. And so I'm going to take you on a little bit of a journey today. And that journey is kind of mine. Okay? No, it's not just kind of mine. It is mine. I was born in 1967. I was the third son of what was soon to be seven children. Okay? So those of you who do the math are probably thinking to yourself, either he's Catholic or he's Mennonite. Okay, it's one of the two. I was born into a Catholic family. Okay, it was a very devout Catholic family. I had a great Catholic experience growing up. I was an altar boy. I served all the time at the church. I went to Catholic school from kindergarten all the way up through my first 2 years of graduate school. I had a great family life. My parents are still married today. I just celebrated with them this summer their 50th wedding anniversary, and you know, they were incredible people. I didn't realize growing up that we were poor, and for some of you, I was rich compared to where you grew up, but where I grew up with seven kids, you know, there just wasn't a lot to go around, but we never wanted for anything. My parents loved me, and they showed that to me in a number of ways. I had the typical stuff going on with my brothers and sisters, you know. My older two brothers beat the crap out of me all the time. And I tried to talk my way out of it. Part of why I'm in psychology is because I got so good at talking my way out of things. But they still beat me up quite frequently. And then I had four younger sisters. And if you want to know anything about psychology, observe four sisters together. Because as my brothers would beat each other up and they would really wail on each other, blood and guts and everything, my sisters were far more ruthless than my brothers were. They weren't physical, but they could hurt each other so badly. And I watched. I had a great childhood. Got to do lots of incredible things, but it was in a small town in southern Indiana, home of basketball. I played basketball. I learned about life and about teamwork and kind of how all that stuff works by playing ball, getting beat up by my older brothers on the basketball court. They were always a lot bigger than me. They grew in sixth grade, and I grew much later than that. I was 4'11 as a freshman in high school. I weighed less than 100 pounds as a freshman in high school. And then I grew. And look at me now. I was 6'5 as a senior in high school. I weighed 135 pounds. But I could hoop it up. I mean, I had a lot of fun on the basketball court. I was not so excited about the classroom, but I was really excited about the basketball court. I like basketball, and I really like girls, you know? And so those two things, they go well together, right? My senior year, we were pretty good. We went to a very small high school, 120 people in my high school. There were 24 in my graduating class. And if you know anything about Indiana, at the time they had what's called single-class basketball. There wasn't six different levels or sizes of schools. Everybody played everybody. There were nine teams that went into our sectional every year, which is the first round of the tournament, and we hadn't won it in 38 years. At the end of the game, with 17 seconds to go in the game, I got fouled. I was a horrible free throw shooter. I was a good basketball player, but I only shot about 60% from the free throw line. And I go to the line, and I hit two shots. That's right. You can clap if you want to. That's all right. Hey, this was awesome. You know, in a small town, when you win sectional, and especially when it hasn't happened in 38 years, you are like gods in that town. I mean, it was like, yes! It was awesome. The girls were coming. I mean, this was sweet. It was awesome. And then we got beat like a drum in the regional round. But let's not go there, okay? I had a good childhood. And yet, I didn't really have a story. At least I didn't think so. You know, then I had this period of time where I go off to college, and I broke the mold in our family. I am the only one in my family who was not salutatorian or valedictorian of their high school class. In fact, there was one who was another sort of black sheep who was the salutatorian. Everybody else was valedictorian. I was seventh. Okay, how many were in my class? 24. That puts me outside of the top 25%. I liked basketball, and I liked girls. That's right, okay. And I told you, I grew up Catholic, and so, you know, when I grew up Catholic, everybody thought that when Matthew got old enough, he would go off to seminary and become a priest. But let's review. I liked girls, that's right. Okay, so I like girls, and it was like, no, I am not going to go to seminary and be a priest because there ain't no girls. So I go off to college. And when I go off to college, my entire family, if you go on both sides, my mom's side and my dad's side, they're either teachers or they're engineers. Two very different fields, by the way, okay? And I said, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go do that. I want to go do psychology. What? What's psychology? I don't have a clue, but I want to go do it. And so I go off to college, and I got to play ball in college, and had an okay time doing that. But I got into psychology, and I loved it. And I started, you know, everybody says you go into psychology for one of two reasons. Either you want to help people, the really, you know, nice high-level thing, or you got something wrong with you or somebody in your family and you're trying to figure them out. Well, I was clearly a part of the first group, you know, because there wasn't anything wrong with me. The further I got, the more I realized there's not much you can do with an undergraduate degree in psychology. I needed to go on. And so I listened to the people around me, and they all said, well, you've got to go into a doctoral program. You know, you're smart enough, which was confusing to me because I wasn't. And then and you have to go into clinical psychology because, well, you're good enough, your scores are high enough, you need to go do that. And so I got into this pattern of starting to do what everybody else told me I should do because I'm not smart enough to figure this out myself. I wasn't, you know, I just didn't have any confidence in what I could do or how I could do it. And so I did that. I applied to some graduate programs and I got accepted and I went off. And I'm going to stop right there for just a second, and I'm going to do a little Bible study with you because this is really important, okay? If I were to ask you what the very first crisis is in the Bible, what story would you go to? Okay, and those of you who have had me in class, please keep your mouth shut, okay, because you know the answer to this, but, you know, what story would you go to? Yeah?
The eating of the forbidden fruit.
The eating of the forbidden fruit, and you find that in what book? Genesis, very good. First book of the Bible, it ought to be there, right? Okay, so you go to Genesis, that's in chapter 3, if I know my Bible well, which I know it better now than I used to. So Genesis chapter 3, that's the fall, huge human crisis, absolutely no question about it. And God's answer to that crisis was to send his son. He sent Jesus to take care of that. Okay, we really don't play much role in responding to the crisis of fallenness. But, you know, that's not the right answer. You know, the right answer actually occurs a chapter earlier in Genesis chapter 2. It's the first time that God said something wasn't good. And what did he say wasn't good? For man to be alone. Genesis 2:18. So aloneness happened before fallenness. Aloneness happened before fallenness. And God's answer to the crisis of aloneness was Eve. I will create a helpmate suitable for him. And in that, what he did is he didn't just establish marriage, like a lot of people say. He established the power and the importance of the human relationship. God chose to address the crisis of aloneness through relationships that we have with other people. I had 7 people in my family who were my peers, who were my brothers and my sisters. There was always chaos at my house growing up because we didn't just show up there by ourselves. We also had our friends there. But it's amazing how in a house that is that full, you can be alone. It's amazing how you have all of these people sitting around you here in chapel today, and you can be here and be very much alone. And that's where I was. Now, I didn't realize it at the time. I wasn't that smart because I was trying to analyze me, and I'm not alone. Look at all the people I got around me. Look at all my friends. I was alone, but I didn't realize it. Well, during that time of college, I got set up on a blind date, okay? I was at a school dance, and the chair of my psychology department, and don't worry, I'm not going to set any of you up, you know, like he did me, although he did pretty well. I was at a dance with a girl, and he's taking pictures, and he says, "Hey, Matt, I've got somebody I want you to meet." And I'm like, "Dude, I got a date, right? Right here." He said, no, I don't care about her. I got somebody I want to set you up with." And I'm like, "Let's talk later." Because I like girls, you know? And so he says, I really want you to meet this person that his wife had met. And so I call this girl up because that's what we do, right? When we want to meet somebody. And so I call her up and I said, "Hey, my name's Matthew." And actually I said Matt because I didn't really become Matthew till I got down here. But that's another story another time. So I said, "Hey, I'm Matt. Drew gave me your name and number. Tell me about yourself." And all I knew was that she had played basketball at Butler University, which was just down the road from where I went to school. And she said, "Well, you know, I'm 5 foot tall. I weigh about 200 pounds. And all of those rumors you hear about, you know, female basketball players in college, all those are true. Okay, just let your mind go wherever it goes, and you'll probably hit somewhere close in the proximity of what she was trying to say to me." And I'm like going, "He would not do that to me. He would not set me up with that." And so I said, no, I'm going to trust him. We're going to go on a date. And so we had a date. And the date was this. She didn't want me to know where she lived. And so she came over to my house, actually my apartment that I lived in with somebody else, and because I didn't want to be alone with this person in case she was 5 foot, 200 pounds, and all that. I had my sister and her boyfriend come, and I had my roommate and his girlfriend come. And I actually took a little liquid courage, I'm not going to lie. Yeah. That was back then, okay? It was a long time ago. Yeah. And so then she shows up at the door, and I open the door, and you know those sound effects that you get in movies where there's the that's what it was like. And I'm like, she's not 5 foot, she's definitely not 200 pounds, and she, dear God, please don't let her be that. And we started dating, and had a great night. I'm not going to tell you what we did that night. You wouldn't approve. The next day, we go to a basketball game. She played at Butler, and her girls' basketball team was playing. And so we're there. We had a great time. We're driving back, and she asked me a question. She says, you know, where do you go to church? And I said, well, you know, I was born Catholic, raised Catholic, always, you know, will be Catholic. And she said, well, I was born Christian, raised Christian, will always be Christian. And I went, that's cool. Not knowing that inside her, something had died because she thought this won't ever work. And I'm like, you know, I didn't know this at the time. I was oblivious because she was hot and I was really into her. I felt not alone for a moment. But she stuck with me, and we continued dating. And so then I go off to graduate school just a few months later, living in St. Louis. She's living here, long distance thing, really hard. Don't recommend it. But we somehow battled through, and then we got married. And I wasn't alone. But I was alone. I got my master's at St. Louis U, then I transferred to Purdue. And at Purdue, I'm in this doctoral program, right? And I'm going through and I'm wrestling with all this theory stuff and trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up and how I want to do it and all of that stuff. And, you know, first couple years we're married, we decide we're not going to have kids because we want to just enjoy being young, unmarried people, unrestrained by kids, all that stuff. But I grew up in a large family. Did I tell you that? There were a lot of kids in my family. And so I wanted to have a lot of kids. And so I got to the point where I really wanted to have kids. And, you know, I was struggling with that. And then she said, let's do it. And so we did. And when we did, we got pregnant right away. You know what I'm saying? Like, one time. No practice? Can I say that in chapel? Okay. I teach psychology. Just keep that in mind. All right. So, you know, we go through this pregnancy thing. We get to see the baby, and we get to hear the heartbeat. It's all like a dream come true. This is awesome. This is like we've been married for 3 years, and then I get a phone call from my wife, and she says, I just had a miscarriage. And I'm like, okay, you know, okay, we'll be all right. You know, it's all going to be good. We're going to get through this. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it, honey. You know, I love you. We'll do what the doctor says. And so we wait the 6 months that you're supposed to wait after that happens. And she was checked out. Everything was fine. And she says, okay, you know, we can try again. And boom! One time. She's pregnant again. And I'm like, this is awesome. What? And so we go through, we hear the heartbeat, all is well. And we go up, and I won't tell you the whole pregnancy thing. If you want to hear that, come to Marriage and Family sometime when I'm teaching it, and you'll get that whole story. But then my son was born. And I call my mom, and I'm so excited. my son is here. I cried through that too. I don't know why I'm crying right now. Maybe because I remember those days, and now he's 19 with hair all over his face, and it's a whole different thing. You know, but I remember what it was like that moment that he came into the world, and I went, I am not alone. And then a couple years go by, and I wanted a big family, and I said, honey, can we have another one? And she said, yes. Boom! This is a pattern I'm not liking very well. And we go, and 12 weeks, we go in, and they did a visual ultrasound, and we got to see the baby, and oh my gosh, it was incredible. And by this time, I had graduated. I had my degree. I was out practicing on top of the world. Everything was good. My practice was booming. I was doing a lot of stuff at church, and I'm pregnant with number two. And I come home for lunch, and I walk in the door, and my wife is standing in the kitchen, and she's crying. And for those of you who don't understand this, when the husband walks in and the wife is crying, your first thought is, what did I do? And she's just standing there and she's crying. And she said, I think I just had a miscarriage. And I'm like, okay, you know, why do you think that? And she said, I think I just had a miscarriage in the toilet. And I'm like, okay. And she goes and she lays down in the bed, and I walk into the bathroom, and I look down, and there in the toilet is our baby. Right here, in the palm of my hand, I held my baby, still in the placenta, perfectly formed. And so I did what every good husband does, right? Every psychologist husband does. I sucked it up, you know? I'm the doctor. I'm the husband. I'm the man of the house. So I'm going to take care of this. Honey, don't worry about a thing. I got this. So I call the doctor and I say, hey, this happened. What do I do? And he said, I need you to put it in a baggie and I need you to bring it to your appointment. And I'm like, okay, we'll be right there. And he said, no, I'm sorry. I won't be in the office until Wednesday. This is a Monday morning. I've got a 3-year-old son running around the house. I've got a wife who's devastated in the bed. And I'm a man. I got to take care of this. And I was all alone. And so I took that baggie and I put it in a brown paper sack and I carried our baby with us for 3 days until the doctor's appointment, never letting my wife see it, never letting my son anywhere near it. And we walk into the appointment and I walk up to the nurse to check in and she said, oh, I see you brought your lunch with you. No. No. We go in, and the doctor was great. He was a strong Christian guy, and he says, you know, I'm so sorry. You know, you're going to get through this. It's going to be all right. And he said, we've got a couple of options of how we can kind of take care of this. You know, we can do a service. We can do a full service, or, you know, you can... Once a quarter, we do these group things where all the people who have lost their loved ones will come together and we do a service together, or you can just let us take care of it. And I really wanted to do a service. I mean, that was like, that made sense to me. Let's honor this life that should have been, and yet I did what every doctor, husband, man does, right? I mean, I said, honey, whatever you want to do. And she said, I just want them to take care of it. Okay, that's what we'll do. And I was desperately alone. We try and get pregnant again as soon as we can, and guess what? This time, there's no bang. And it goes on and on and on and on. Nothing. Medication, tests, all this stuff, nothing. And then my wife comes home on a Thursday night and she says, I'm done. I'm done. We're not going to do this anymore. And I was more alone than ever. And I'll be honest, I made some choices at that point in my life that just are not choices that should ever be made. I responded to that pain that I felt in some very, very unhealthy ways. And you can fill in the blanks on that however you want, and you probably would not even come close to what I did. And I was so depressed, I was so alone, that I thought that taking my life was the very best answer. And so I drove on an interstate where there are thousands and thousands of semis every day looking for a semi to run into. I drove for 25 minutes and there was not a single semi on the road. You know, because if you hit a semi, you are gone and the semi truck is fine. You know, that was my thinking. Gone. And then the greatest thing that's ever happened in my life unfolded from that moment on. I pulled into a McDonald's parking lot. McDonald's is not the greatest thing. And I looked to my left, and there are thousands of semi-trucks parked right next to the McDonald's. And I get on the phone and I reached out to a friend of mine who then had me go and meet another friend of mine. And I recognized for the first time in my life that Genesis 2:18 is not just what I was to live out with other people, it was meant for me too. I was not supposed to be alone either, and I had put myself in a position where that's all I was, that's all I felt. And then God brought not just one person, but he brought me hundreds of people into my life to walk with me through what was the worst period of my life. And I have wrestled with depression all of my adult life. But from that moment, 17 years ago, to today, I don't do it alone anymore. That's why I love so much what I get to do. That's why I love how God has taken somebody who was so broken, so screwed up, so alone, and said, there's still something I want to do with you. There's still ways that I want to use you, ways that you cannot imagine. And so I get to sit here today in a room with a bunch of people that I've gotten the opportunity to pour into their life because of where I've been. I haven't shared my whole testimony. You will probably, most of you, never hear my whole testimony. But if you take nothing else from today, I pray that you take this. You don't have to be alone. It was never God's intent for you to be alone. Never was it God's intent for you to be alone. Whatever you're going through, no matter how bad it is, no matter how crappy your life has been, you are not meant to go through life alone. Not now, not ever. God said, I will create a helpmate suitable for you. That's what I do with my life. I walk with people as God does whatever restorative work he wants to do in their life. I help people not be alone as God fixes them. The friends that you have here in this room are who God has put into your life for such a time as this. Your professors are the people that God has put in your life for such a time as this. You don't need to be alone. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for stories, and I thank you for what you have allowed to transpire in mine. I thank you for how, in response to that moment where I thought that the end of life was the right thing for me, you have continued to bless me, that you blessed me with a second child. You showed me in such a powerful way that you intended for me to live not just for that moment, but for every moment that comes after. For all of the people that you have brought into my life, the Mark Worleys, the Mark Halens, the Melissa LaGranges, the Lucas LaGranges, the Ellie LaGranges, the Drew Shermans, all of the people that you brought into my life, I thank you for them. I thank you for the people that you have poured into, those that are here. I pray that you would open their eyes to the people that you want them to walk through life with, and those that are already walking in their life with them. I pray that they would not feel so alone today, that they would feel your love and your care. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.